The Marine Corps says its first squadron of F-35B Joint Strike Fighters is just about ready for combat after nearly 20 years of development. It's the first JSF model to reach initial operational capability, but the Defense Department spends so far nearly $100 billion on the process. Jim Hassock is Senior Fellow at the Brent Scowcroft Center on International Security at the Atlantic Council and writing about what the Pentagon could have done if it decided not to buy the JSF in the first place. There are folks, I imagine, in Washington, Jim, thanks for being on the program today, who are celebrating the idea and thinking about a lot of what-ifs today. But we are 20 years into this process. What caused you to want to think about the JSF in this way in the first place? Thanks for your time today.
Oh, thanks. No, it's good to be here. These alternative histories are just in some ways are total speculation and they're fun fiction, but one of the reasons that we like to go back and reconsider decisions is so that when you find future decision points where you'd wonder, gosh, 20 years down the road, what sort of situation will I find myself in if I take the fork less traveled? How can I look back and wonder how other decisions have gone? And so it isn't so much that we wondered here at the council, what would we do, now about the program? But what should you worry about perhaps in 20 years if you were doing something different? So that was what led to a couple of conversations, particularly with my colleague Alex Cole here, the co-author of Ghost Fleet, about what could have happened back in 93 or 94 if the Clinton administration had not decided to proceed with the program, but it instead let the services tackle their fighter shortfalls on their own. And I think you would have come up with some fairly, at least in the short run, I don't want to say pedestrian, but some small ball sort of solutions, where the Navy might very well have bunted and at least initially been very happy with its Super Hornet fleet, wouldn't really have wound up with a shortfall. They could have spent a far smaller amount of money rather than paying Lockheed Martin and its partners to develop a wholly new jet. They wouldn't have a shortfall on their fighter, on their carrier decks. They'd have all kinds of airplanes. But of course, you've got a budget, and then the question is, what do you do with that budget? And in lieu of another manned aircraft, the direction they've been going the last couple of years, speculating about the need for longer range strike, particularly in the Western Pacific, where there is a near peer competitor with legions of missiles facing the other way, very long range missiles that outrange those Hornets, that yet will outrange the F-35C when it's available. You wonder if maybe they wouldn't have doubled down on some of the small bets they've been making lately on drones and gone for a more unmanned fleet earlier in time. So it's all very speculative, but this is some of the things we've been wondering about.
Let's step back a moment or two and look at some of the other things that you point out in this piece that we have linked at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. You write, the Typhoon was similarly to the F-35 in development for 20 years before its entry into service in 2003. What can we look at when it comes to the Typhoon development and deployment that can either be a lesson in what to do or a lesson in what not to do?
I think the two things come to mind. The first one is that aircraft programs these days, and this has been the case for decades, take a long time. Some of that is just a feature of modern aircraft. It takes jetliner manufacturers more than a few years, to say the least, to build a new Airbus, to build a new Boeing. So we need to temper our expectations as to how much we can get how soon. But also, I think with the Eurofighter, there is a complication politically that we also saw with, or we have seen with Joint Strike Fighter, that when we try to satisfy multiple customers' ambitions, whether it's for mission sets or work share or whatever it might be, those operational or those industrial complications stretch out the programs even further. So you know the Eurofighter costs much more than it should cost because they're building the left wing in one country and the right wing in another just to satisfy all the investment partners. The F-35 has taken a good bit longer than it should than another airplane might have. I hesitate to say should have, but another airplane might have because we needed to pack mission sets for the Navy, for the Air Force, for the Marine Corps, for the Royal Navy, and a whole bunch of other customers into a single airplane. And when you try to stuff, you know, 10 pounds of stuff into a 5-pound bag, you're going to have problems.
A question comes to mind that I didn't intend to get into this afternoon, but as we discuss this stuff, I think it makes a lot of sense, Jim, and that is, if the warfighting landscape is so different 20 years ago than it is today, that the problems or issues, it's not fair to call it problems, issues with the JSF are what they are, how do we go about trying to plan and figure what we'll need 20 years from now, anticipating that with the drive in technology, that the warfighting landscape will be entirely different again and a lot faster than 20 years from now?
Right. So foresight is very hard. You know, like Barra said, prediction's hard, particularly about the future. it's one of the things that we at think tanks like to think that we do better than average. But there are systems that can be more flexible than others. Okay, so whatever concerns we have, for example, about, you know, the role of supercarriers in the future, there's a lot you can do with, as they say, you know, acres of real estate, acres of sovereign territory at sea. You might put manned aircraft on them. You might put drones on them, unmanned aircraft. You might find that you can use them to transport paratroopers and helicopters to Haiti in 1994. You can do all kinds of stuff with relatively flexible systems that smart officers and strategists can figure out how to repurpose. But there are limitations to what you can do with an airplane that was designed for a particular, how should I say, political understanding of the world. In the 90s, where we were trying to maximize the ability of aircraft to sortie off aircraft carrier decks for fairly short-range missions, like the kind the United States was involved in places like Somalia and Bosnia and Kosovo, but not the kind that you would expect that you would be involved in if you were dealing with a big war in the Western Pacific. It is very challenging. I think one of the things that we might wind up ruining in the future is that this was the single program, and that the Pentagon decided it was going to fit all the requirements into an airplane that has about a 700-mile range. And because you can't get to 800 miles, you can't get to 900 miles after you've designed the airplane, right? And that's what I worry about, is that that everything has gone into a single form factor.
You write about the skipped generation of technology that then Texas Governor George W. Bush talked about in 1999 as he prepared to run for president. And you make a note that I think is worth pursuing. Just which generation remains a fair question. If we've skipped the fourth generation, well, obviously we couldn't skip the fourth generation. We're now on the fifth generation, and considering the sixth generation, and I don't know that we've necessarily derived a benefit or would have derived a benefit from skipping a generation.
Well, right. Which generation is the question?
Yeah.
One of the things I try to point out in the piece is that there hasn't been a benefit yet to the Joint Strike Fighter program. Now, this is a little churlish in that, you know, it's easy to conceive of a scenario where those capabilities will be absolutely vital in a war in 2025, and where your Eagles and your Flying Falcons and your Super Hornets would be badly outclassed by an enemy you could conceive of. Of course, we also did hear this back in the early 90s when we were told that, you know, the Soviets and the Russians were about to build a stealth fighter, and we're still kind of waiting for that. So this kind of what has he got planning is very hard to do. What makes people uncomfortable about the Joint Strike Fighter program or the F-35 at this point is that if it's a fifth generation fighter, it is in some ways designed to solve military problems that were clear in the 90s, but are less obviously the stressing problems of today.
First of all, I'm enticed, Jim, by the fact that that means that there'll be at least a part two, and I look forward to that part of the conversation as you continue to roll out this work. But the next to last paragraph of this piece, I think, was my favorite. You write about the initial, the beginnings of the drone program. You write, in 1999, NATO lost 30 drones over Yugoslavia, a loss that would have been alarming had the aircraft been manned. In 2001, Predators were firing missiles over Afghanistan. By 2007, turboprop MQ-9 Reapers were taking their place. The next year, the 138th Attack Squadron of the New York Air Guard became the first unit to trade its fighters for drones. Lockheed Martin brought out the RQ-170 Sentinel. Around that same time, Northrop Grumman worked up its presumably larger and longer-range RQ-180. Then Northrop showed its X-47Bs could take off from carriers, refuel in the air, and then land on those carriers. All of that suggests to me that, to some degree, the concept of a fighter like the F-35, maybe not the particular program, but the possibility of a program like that, is now, because of technology and maybe Moore's Law, if nothing else, so easily overcome by events that, in addition to, as you cite, Navy Secretary Ray Mabus calling it the last, almost certainly the last manned strike fighter, might it be the last long-term, long-range, big program, because these programs so easily become subsumed by what other technology is available in the meantime?
Honestly, I think that's the most important lesson about the F-35 program. It's we have a hard time looking into the future 20 years and knowing this is exactly the weapon system that we're going to need. So whether or not, you mentioned Moore's Law, you know, when you build an airplane, when you build a stealth airplane, you bake most of the stealthiest in right at the design. And yet Moore's Law keeps advancing. And even if it ran out, as some people are predicting in the next couple of years, we'd still be rewriting our software for years to make it more effective. We're going to see computing advances, you know, in terms of the intelligence computer systems for quite a long time. Signal processing power is going to go up. The stealthiness of the aircraft, because of the ability of radars to process information, is going to keep dropping. So it's not that it's not important. It's that that particular attribute is going to start falling off. We've noticed that missiles are so effective at the speed of aircraft. That probably is going to be less important. John Stillian over the CSB, I think, has done some very good work on this subject. And the Navy knows this, and the Air Force knows this. And so that is part of the reason that they're wondering about what else needs to be done around the F-35 program, perhaps with giving the pilots, you know, unmanned wingmen in the future to extend the capacity, you know, the offensiveness of their aircraft further into areas where you wouldn't want to hazard, say, $100 million, $150 million fighter jet. They're thinking about these things, absolutely. But we might not be in quite that position if we hadn't had a 20-year program that tried to put so much capability into a single aircraft. It is entirely possible. This is going to be an amazing airplane when it's done. I hope, though, that the lesson we take away from it is, oh my gosh, let's never try something that ambitious again, because we will find ourselves in 20 years trying to figure out how to patch the operational concept to meet the new military political realities.
I think the optimism then that people might take away from all of this discussion is that that message seems to be getting through to the people that it should get through to. This is a quote from the Secretary of the Air Force, Deborah Lee James, at the Aspen Security Forum in Colorado last week, courtesy of the Business Insider. "The biggest lesson I've learned from the F-35 is never again should we be flying an aircraft when we're building it. People believe we could go faster, cheaper, better by designing and building the F-35 concurrency, and that the degree of concurrency would work. It hasn't worked as well as we'd hoped, and that's probably the understatement of the day." So people know that the issues that you're pointing out and that other people are pointing out about this long development cycle and the way the testing has gone along with it, it doesn't work and isn't ever likely to work.
You know, Frank Kendall called it acquisition malpractice to attempt concurrent development and production. It isn't when you're trying something that's not hard to do, but we all knew this was going to be hard to do. And we had actually, heck, we had the academic research 20 years ago Michael Brown over at George Washington looked at the history of Air Force bomber programs over the last several decades and found that, you know, the real serious financial fiascos occurred when contractors were told to build it while they were designing it, and the designing it was going to be hard. It was kind of crazy what we started 20 years ago, and we should have known better way back then.
Another element of what you wrote in this piece, what if there'd never been a Joint Strike Fighter, as you laid out this chain of events in the history of drone programs, something that jumped out at me is the statement that you made earlier in the first part of our conversation. We have a budget, to use your words. And it strikes me that it's especially critical, given the budget situation we're in right now, to make choices that are based on trying to anticipate the landscape 20 years from now. And I you're exactly right when you said that figuring that stuff out in the future is very hard. I'm not suggesting that it's simple, but I wonder if that doesn't apply to continuing current programs as much as it applies to developing new ones.
I think it does absolutely to both. It's a fun thing in this town for some folks in the Congress to say that we shouldn't have a budget-driven strategy. Maybe instead we should have a strategy-driven budget. I think that's a little too easy to say. There's always a budget constraint. There are always choices that may need to be made regardless of the amount of money that you're allocating to defense. There are rising threats, we think now, at least in Europe and in the Western Pacific, that we really didn't see in the 1990s when we started this program. There are hard choices to be made. When you've got that situation, when you think the threats are increasing and you're unsure as to exactly which ones are the most threatening, it does make sense to spread some of the money around on small bets that might have the potential for high payoff. And I think that's what happened with the flurry of drone programs over the last 20 years, that unmanned aviation in particular is a technology or a set of technologies that have had a relatively rapid rate of advance. And not everything that the armed forces have spent money on have had the same kind of potential. Some folks saw this and made some smart bets 20 years ago and were in a better position today because of it.
I guess the thing to keep in mind, too, or one thing to keep in mind, is that it's possible that we could go just as hog wild on drones and go and be back in the same all the eggs in one basket thing with drones as we seem to be as far as inventory goes with the F-35 right now.
Well, if you decided you were going to go replace all of the Army and the Marine Corps and the Air Force's attack aircraft with Reapers, then you might find yourself in that position. If we got into a position where every time somebody said, well, manned aircraft, the answer was, oh, let's just take the pilot out of it, it will be fine, you might find yourself in that position. We sort of find ourselves in that position with satellite navigation, where not much in the U.S. military functions without a GPS signal anymore. And as senior a guy as Ash Carter has pointed out, I think I need to get out of that situation because it creates a systemic vulnerability across all the department's warfighting capabilities. So, yes, you don't want to go too far with any single bet.
Jim, it's a terrific piece, and I look forward to part two, as I mentioned, What If There'd Never Been a Joint Strike Fighter, published by the Atlantic Council, and I thank you for coming on to talk about it with me today.
We're working on part two now, and thanks. It was very good talking.